Jesus save.
Mormon Mental Health is a production of Mormon Stories Podcast and the Open Stories Foundation. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards supporting its listeners. To support the podcast, please consider a donation today at mormonmentalhealth.org. And thanks for listening. Jordan Compass
came from the... Hello and welcome to another episode of Mormon Mental Health. This is Natasha Helfer Parker, and today I have the privilege of having John Larson on the show. Hello, John. Thanks for being here.
Well, hello, and thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here. You have a fabulous studio, by the way.
Yes, you are letting me borrow your studio. Very nice of you.
My pleasure.
Well, John is...
And welcome to Salt Lake City,
by the
way. Oh, yes,
thank you. I am in Salt Lake this week. It's been a pleasure to be here from the plains of Kansas. So John is the founder of the Mormon Expression Podcast, which some of you may be familiar with, but he's also the founder of the Whitefields Education Foundation, and that's really what I'm here to talk with you about today, because I'm really interested and intrigued about some of the services and things that you're trying to develop for people in particular who are going through faith transition crises. So I'm hoping to kind of do two things today. One is talk about Whitefields Education and have you kind of explain to us a little bit about what that's all about and what services you're offering. And two is kind of get a sense from you. I mean, I know that you've kind of gone through your own faith stuff yourself, and you have worked with many people who have as well.
Right.
Maybe give us a sense of what you think some of the top things are that people should be considering wherever they're at on the spectrum as far as understanding what those who are going through faith transitions are going through. So we can be more empathic, or we can be more understanding. And for those of us who maybe are going through faith transitions, also understand what's normal instead of thinking that everything is weird or faulting themselves or things of that nature.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Feeling like you're broken.
That's right.
Exactly.
Okay. So let's start with Whitefields.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, Whitefields, we originally incorporated nonprofit around the podcast, and it was, you know, as it started to grow and there were more people involved and we needed to incorporate, well, we said, well, what do we really want to accomplish? And it also sort of represented an arc that I had. When I first started the podcast, I was just, as I went through my own faith transition, I became very interested and fascinated in Mormon history and Mormon theology and just how strange and wonderful and weird and vibrant it was. Here we were watching the rise of a religion after the invention of the printing press. We had all this history and fascinating human interaction to study. And I lost my faith during that process. Others have retained theirs, and that's fine. But it just was so interesting that I just wanted to talk about it. As we started the podcast, I discovered a new and interesting world that I really didn't know existed, and that was all of this pain and all of this swirling human interaction. And people started reaching out to me in a lot of ways that were completely unexpected, because I was sometimes the one voice that they had, because they felt alone, they felt isolated, they didn't feel like they could talk to anybody about their faith crisis. And here was this podcast, and they could plug me into their ear, and suddenly they had a friend. So that was the genesis of where we eventually have ended up with Whitefields, because I found I was in way over my head very quickly. People were calling me and talking to me about all sorts of problems, from sexual issues to faith issues to everything in between, probably things they would normally talk to their bishop about, that I became this voice that they connect with. So as the podcast developed and I went on my own faith journey, you know, there were times that I've been more angry at the church or more angry at those things, but I realized in time that something big was going on here, and something that I didn't quite understand. As I've talked to more psychologists and therapists and doctors about these things casually, but I've come to understand that the whole process, whether people end up in the church or outside the church, has more to do with individual identity. And it's that identity crisis that people go through, which is much more important, in my mind, than the faith crisis. The faith crisis is secondary. Now, they're intertwined because in a religion like Mormonism, so much of one's identity is tied up in the faith. You know, your marriage, what's going to happen to you in the afterlife, how you raise your kids, what you do on a Thursday night, what you do on Sunday, what you wear, what you don't wear, what you ingest. Almost everything that we do in this world gets impacted rather significantly by the Mormon faith. And when one loses their faith, it becomes this house of cards and this valley of confusion as people try to rebuild who they are and what they stand for and what their values are, because we see this happen all the time with ex-Mormons, where they just do a reversal. Where, you know, they're Mormons, and then suddenly they're ex-Mormons. They turn everything that was black and they turn it white. And, you know,
the classic pendulum shift.
Yes, yes. And I've talked about in a podcast recently, you know, this three-phase identity, you know, where we're staunch Mormons. And oftentimes the ones who struggle most as ex-Mormons were the ones who took Mormonism very seriously. There's plenty of people out there who don't take it as seriously, for good or for bad. And then the transition out of the church is not as serious.
Correct.
But the ones who take it seriously then suddenly take their ex-Mormonism too seriously, and then they have to go through a third transformation when they turn into a normal person. So yeah, the podcast has helped me see that identity. So you asked about Whitefields. As we had this nonprofit entity that was wrapped around the podcast and then some other endeavors, we started saying, well, what can we really do to help people? Because the only reason I keep doing the podcast is that it is helpful for some people. And my aim in the podcast is to help people deconstruct their own faith. Not necessarily in an abstraction. I obviously have my own opinion about the church and about faith, and then I'm not shy to express that. But it's really about helping people kind of see that there's other models and there's other ways to process faith. But that is inadequate in and of itself. It's a help for some people, and then they need to move on. For other people, there are huge impacts. So we wanted to focus in on that identity and not necessarily telling people what their new identity need to be. They've had plenty of that in more fundamentalist religion. But what we want to do is focus on how do people do healthy transformations. So in this year, 2014, we set a roadmap for expansion to help with this identity crisis. And one of the first areas we moved into was counseling. And that's why this little studio here exists. It's actually used part-time as a studio. It's used more often to do our workshops and our group therapy sessions. And so what we did is we started finding therapists and counselors who are, you know, certified, who are professionals, who know what they're doing. We're not a healthcare provider at all. But what we wanted to do is facilitate those healthcare services. And so that was one of our major aims this year, was to help in the kind of things that people would be dealing with, the kind of crises they would have as they transition their faith.
One of the reasons I have you on is because part of my goals at Mormon Mental Health is to be able to help LDS folk anywhere on the spectrum that they're at, whether believing or non-believing or transitioning. And I think that that's, you know, as I've been listening to some of the work that you've been doing, that's what drew me to wanting to interview you today, is the fact that you're focusing on this help for people who need to transition without necessarily going through some of the choices that we see through transition processes, such as divorce or cutting off family members or things like that. I'm not saying that those things can't ever happen or shouldn't ever happen. I'm just saying to be able to do that with as least amount of ripple effect as possible, I guess, to the rest of your life.
Absolutely. And we keep using the word transition, and it's a valuable word. And it's something, as we frame this out, you know, from my perspective as sort of a secular agnostic, my journey was to go from, you know, a fairly staunch conservative Mormonism to the secular view that doesn't have any supernatural. But that's not the path that everyone takes, nor necessarily should they. And we really try to narrow the message down to this identity and transformation. And we're not really saying point A to point B. We're saying we want to give you the skill set to help you find what point B should be for you. And I think it's a subtle but important distinction, because if people can develop the tools to establish a healthy identity and stay in the church, well, then they've made a healthy transformation, and that's really what we're after. So all of the therapists who work for us, you know, that's one thing, we work with them very carefully. If you review our materials, it doesn't mention Mormonism anywhere, nor does it mention, you know, like deconstructing the faith or arriving at anything, because we're really focusing on that internal identity as opposed to any sort of finish line.
Yeah, and I really appreciate you saying that, because I was going to ask you next, what's the vetting process like, you know, as you try to find some of these mental health professionals? Because one of the projects I'm currently working on is the Mormon Mental Health Association, which is this idea of how do we as Mormon professionals in the mental health field help LDS or other you know, denominational people, and wherever their journey is, instead of feeling like somehow our role is to either keep them in the church or, you know, be able to only do therapies that church policy would be, what do I want to say, I guess, give their support to. Does that make sense? So this mm-hmm. is like some of the issues that we find with reparative therapy or addiction language that isn't necessarily supported by diagnosis, or some of the problems that I see as a mental health professional, for example, when treating LDS folks in ways that I don't know that are completely professionally supported.
Yeah, that's a great question on the vetting process, and one that we spend a lot of time thinking about. We really have two resources. We have an online directory of therapists across the country that's growing slowly. And because we want to find the right people, we want them to be attracted to what we're doing and us to feel comfortable with them. That being said, we have therapists on our list who are faithful people, who are people of faith. But we're looking for therapists who are committed to sort of healthcare standards. I don't know what you would say.
Like code of ethics.
The code of ethics, that they have professional certification, that they're licensed, first of all, that they're not going to use faith in their therapeutic approaches. So, they don't need to condemn faith, but we don't want them pushing people to any one place or the other. So, for our initial therapists, either myself or Lindsay Park, you're going to be talking to, we sit down with them individually and talk to them for an hour and hear about their approaches. We've also looked for some crossover areas in mental health. For example, we've found that almost all of our therapists have themselves dealt with, a faith crisis of their own, mm-hmm. or had significant experience dealing with people. A lot of our therapists are actually have strong experience working with LGBT issues, mm-hmm. because the process of coming out has a lot of parallels.
Yes.
And also therapists who had significant experience with family counseling, divorce, and couples counseling, because mm-hmm. those sort of issues, first of all, generally impact people to some degree or the other. If they're married, the faith crisis is going to impact their marriage. And those areas are similar. So we were looking for those crossovers. But yeah, it was fascinating because I started looking around in the mental health world that there's not a great association. There's not, you know, there's not a lot of therapists who are hanging a shingle dealing with this. If you go onto your healthcare provider website, you know, divorce and anxiety and this long list of things that therapists work with, but you won't see anything there on faith transition, at least
right.
not yet.
Right. No, that's a good point. Yeah, because, I mean, as a faith therapist myself, I think that this is an important thing to be able to figure out. I mean, so much of what the ethics classes that we go to are about is how do we keep our own biases outside of the therapy room. It's not fair to project our own spirituality or our own religious biases onto the client and their journey. And so that's, I think, something that we all as therapists struggle with. And I think it's really important what you're doing as far as trying to vet people who are experienced and understand and are willing to abide by those ethical codes.
Yeah, and we use a little bit stronger vetting process for the ones who are coming here doing workshops. For the ones who are just hanging their shingle, what I've asked them all to do is sort of write their philosophy and put it on the website. And then what we try to do is when individuals come to us and looking for therapists, we try to coach them a little bit through the kind of questions you would ask a therapist. And I eventually want to put up like 20 questions to ask your therapist on your first visit. But as you know, Mormonism in particular has a strong bias against therapists. And this carries over into the ex-Mormon, into like liberal Mormon communities. And, you know, part of our mission is just overcoming that bias. And one of the things that Lindsay and I have been doing in the podcast, kind of subtly, is almost every podcast we talk about how each of us have been to therapy and that it's okay. It's okay to go to therapy because I think in Mormon culture, that's a sign of being broken, mm-hmm. right? That's you're not doing things right. You're not righteous. You're sinning. And that's simply not true. And it's a bias we want to overcome.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I think it's a cultural bias at large in the United States for sure, but Mormonism, I think, definitely falls into that big time because we are doers. We're working bees, right? And we're good at what we do. You know, Mormons are very hardworking people, but oftentimes there are things that are not about working it out. You know, it's more about acceptance or understanding where you're coming from and identity shifts and things like that. Okay. So it sounds like you're doing groups. Sounds like you're doing referrals to vetted mental health professionals that are ethical in their practice. It sounds like you also have like a referral list of some sort for people who maybe are not in the Salt Lake City area for therapists around the country. Is that correct?
Yeah. We will refer. There are several of our therapists who will do Skype sessions. So we have even if you can't find somebody around, and when you go to our website at Whitefields and look at the therapist, they should indicate in there if they do that. And right. Then we're trying to grow that network. We're actually looking at expanding our workshop services, the face-to-face meetings, and we're in preliminary negotiations and looking at in Phoenix and Boise in the next 6 or 9 months.
Okay.
So you know, we're trying to expand these services out as far as we can.
But, and what kind of groups are you offering?
Well, the we started in the spring, and then we're going to take the summer off, and then we're starting again in the fall. We had three particular groups that we offered in the spring. We had one that was just on identity, you know, helping individuals walk through that, establishing identity and establishing your own boundaries in that outside of a religious framework. That was a really great, well-received session. Mormonism has particular issues in relationship to feminism and how women identify themselves. You know, for example, women are often encouraged to drop out of school and start having children and have families young. So they have a double-edged faith crisis because sometimes they're behind where their peers are and they haven't necessarily thought about career and that sort of thing. I just use that as an example for our next session, which was very successful, which was women's only, where the people in that group were in, you know, it was kind of a safe environment. It was just females, and they were focusing on some of the issues of identity that impact women in particular. My favorite session that we did was one where we had two therapists, and I was talking just now how we talked about we selected the therapists because they were religious neutral. I did make an exception for this. We had two therapists who led the session together. One was an ex-Mormon, and the other was a believing Mormon. I gave him like a bishop's interview to make sure that he really was a believer. We had a woman and a man, one of the therapists was single, one was married. And then it was a session for couples where one had left Mormonism or whatever faith they were in, and the other was still in. And the session was really not about who is right, who's wrong, but how do you establish communication patterns? How do you rebuild a marriage when you have this transition? And the feedback I got back from it was a great journey for them. It was, as you can imagine, difficult, but really helpful. So in the fall, we're looking at continuing those faith identity. We're expanding into dealing with LGBT issues. We're going to start a workshop for parents, friends, family who have children or younger folks who they think may be gay or recently come out. Oftentimes, we want to be good allies, but we really don't know what to do. You know, mm-hmm. if you suspect your son or your daughter is going to come out of the closet, how do you approach that? So that's a workshop we're going to be starting. We have one that we're starting in the fall on how to divorce. There's a lot of workshops and therapy on couple therapy and keeping together. Well, what happens when you actually decide to pull the trigger? So in that one, we're having multiple sessions, one that's led by a child psychologist to talk about how to talk to your children, one that's led by a mediator to talk about how to talk to your ex-spouse, one that's an attorney talks about the laws. We have a panel that will appear of people who have successfully had amicable divorces and how they've done it. So we can just model some of those good behaviors. Again, it's not really – it's the same model we have for religion. We're not saying you should stay together or get divorced, but if you're going to get divorced, do it right.
Right.
And then we have some other sessions along that line. We also, outside the therapy, we're looking at other areas. You know, I've talked about women entering the workplace. We're working on sessions on how to write a resume, what kind of jobs are out there, and just working on – because it's not all just about mental disorder, which is what people think about when they think about therapy. But that's not – as you and I know, that's not what it is.
Right. No, that's great. That's wonderful. I can get behind all of those efforts for sure. And these groups that you're describing, I'm assuming they're more than just one session. Like they're things that people come back to on a weekly basis, or is it a one session
We haven't done any one session yet. They've all been 6 or 8 week sessions.
Yeah, so that
the therapist has time to work things out with them. And, you know, we're building up a curriculum and that sort of thing. So it's reproducible. So I was mentioning before that our aim and our focus has always been to move it outside of Salt Lake City. So we're looking at developing these patterns so that we can train therapists up on, you know, what's worked and what hasn't worked. And we can continue that way.
Right. That's great. Okay. So let's shift maybe a little bit more then onto, I mean, you touched on some of these things as you were beginning to talk, but into some of the kind of classic themes that come up for people as they do find themselves in transition. So you mentioned taboo. You know, there's a lot of taboo in any culture, I guess. You know,
right.
Every culture has its rules, and every culture kind of tells you how to behave within that culture. And so when people are starting to move away from those types of things, what tends to happen? What are some of the taboo things that happen in Mormonism in particular that are so difficult to talk about?
The what part's difficult to talk about for people who are outside the faith?
Yeah, so let's talk about them first. Then we'll talk about people who are still in, who want to either help or are saying things that are not helpful or things of that nature. But let's start with the people who are moving away.
Well, the people who are out, that's an important distinction. I'm glad you're bringing it up. People who move out and abandon their faith. Now, I have a bias towards people who become secular or sort of agnostic. And I hear a lot of people say, well, why does everybody leave the church become an atheist? And I have to remind people that it's selectional bias, because if you leave the church and become a Baptist, you don't go hang out with the atheists in Salt Lake City. You go hang out with the Baptists.
Right.
And I was told a long time ago, I can't remember who told me, the general rule of thumb is if you go to any congregation in the state of Utah, a third of the congregation are ex-Mormons. So if you go to the Baptists, the Methodists, or Catholics, they're full of people who have made those transitions. I think we should kind of put those folks aside for a while, because they get a new framework that's given to them by the new religion.
Okay.
So when we're talking about people who kind of leave on a secular basis, they don't have that framework. And we know that in Mormonism, the framework can be very staunch. It's no sex before marriage, and then sex is okay after marriage. It's not anything nuanced, like it's okay to have a loving, committed sexual relationship outside of marriage. So when you come to sort of ethical and moral breakdown, Mormonism tends to be a lot more structured and black and white. So once folks leave, then they suddenly they're in this big, wild, wild, scary place. I remember when I left the MTC after 9 weeks in the MTC in Provo, like getting on the bus, just absorbing that and feeling like I was driving out into the big, scary world, right? To drive to the airport from the MTC. And
well, we talk about the big, scary world a lot.
We do.
Yeah.
And we talk about that, us and them. And it's sort of a helpful construction when you're setting up an identity. What does it mean to be Mormon? But a lot of what it means to be Mormon on the outward side, I mean, the Mormon faith is obviously about a lot more than, say, things like the Word of Wisdom. But those are the easy problems. And it's funny because ex-Mormons gravitate towards those, partly because the question of what do I do? Do I drink coffee? Do I drink beer? Do I have sex with other people? All these questions suddenly come into focus. They can be very difficult, and I think, unfortunately, ex-Mormons funnel a lot of their identity into that.
Into those behavioral aspects.
Well, and we see that in in-groups all the time. You know, if you're wearing the in-group costume, and then suddenly you lose that costume, well, carrying around a Starbucks is a new in-group identity.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think a lot of ex-Mormons are drawn to those things and drawn to trying to explore and find out where their boundaries are. Watching my children grow up and watching all these ex-Mormons grow up, my theory is that people sort of learn their boundaries by bumping into them. The normal in our culture now is that people sort of do that in college. Like they figure out sexually and drugs and alcohol where they're comfortable. If you're in the church for 40 years and you've been a teetotaler, suddenly you don't know where you stand. And you have to do some exploration. One of the things we've been trying to combat, and I'm going to sound a little paternalistic here, but that's okay. We recently, Whitefields also acquired Post-Mormon a few months ago. And one of the reasons we did is because Post-Mormon has had these structures these communities that are around. And we don't want to impact those communities, but what we want to do is kind of set a safe place. So we're working with these local community leaders right now to set a code of conduct, to say, if you go to a post-Mormon activity, there's no underage drinking, there's no drugs, there's no sexual activity. So there's a kind of a safe landing place. Because what's happened oftentimes with ex-Mormons is you'll go to ex-Mormon parties and there'll be a bunch of 30-year-olds acting like frat boys. But it's a short window. The problem is that ex-Mormons sort of get labeled by that. If you go to those same parties 6 months later, you'll have a whole new group of people, because most people do their boundary exploration and then they move on to where they're going to be at, if that makes sense.
Right.
So they might get smashed on vodka once or twice and they say, I don't like that at all. I don't like having a hangover. I don't like the way it makes me feel. And it's really just a brief exploration. But the unfortunate thing is that's what ex-Mormonism appears to be, because it's always happening at this border, even though the people themselves are moving on to healthy places.
Right.
So you kind of asked what we've dealt with. The alcohol is not that big of an issue. I have been around long enough to see ex-Mormons who struggle with alcoholism, but I would say not at a higher rate than the general populace or even in the church population. Because if you deal with mental health in the church, you know there's problems with addiction and alcoholism inside the church.
Absolutely.
Too.
Correct.
One of the big ones that I've been really reticent to talk about, I think that's coming to the point we need to, is sexual exploration with ex-Mormons. And it happens because if somebody spends 30 years in the church and they've only ever been with one person, and then they lose their faith in God, they lose their faith in the afterlife, that's a hard pill to swallow, to say, I'm not going to have any of these other sexual experiences. But playing
maybe
around,
now they feel like they've missed out on
their teenagerhood or college life.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And I'm surprised how many ex-Mormons, including myself, you know, basically didn't date. You know, you found the first person who you clicked with and then you married them, right?
Right.
But playing around with sexuality, especially when you're married, can be impactful. Now,
and tricky.
It can be tricky. Yeah, there's some people who do it successfully. I mean, out there, you can, if you go search the interwebs, you'll find that there's all sorts of alternative family arrangements out there that people run successfully. But like you said, it can be tricky. And not everybody does these things. And oftentimes people experiment lightly and then they'll move on and they're fine. It's sort of what I was talking about before, that border exploration.
Right.
But it is difficult to watch sometimes. And this is one of the reasons that we're trying to develop these structures with Whitefields, because I think a lot of the healthy people will have these parties for a little while and then they say, I'm tired of the chaos, and they move on. And that's why we want to help build those structures out to help people figure out their own identity without feeling like they have to do this, that, or the other.
Well, I think this is such an interesting point, and definitely things that I see as well is that you're bringing up this point that identity is so based on behavior at times. And I think oftentimes, I mean, unfortunately, when I go to church pretty much weekly, a lot of the sermons that we hear are based on behavior. Mm-hmm. It is behaviorally based. I mean, we're very much a works-oriented people. And so I think that to your point, when people decide, okay, this is not where I identify anymore, then those behaviors are exactly what comes up. And we do focus a lot on sexual behavior at church. We focus a lot on morality, which is usually siphoned through sexuality. We focus a lot on addiction language. We focus a lot on those types of things, which again goes to words of wisdom. And I think, and then, you know, we'll talk about this a little bit further, but this also taps into then the fear of those who are continuing to be active, that when they see their loved ones starting these behavioral paths, I mean, that's what I hear a lot from spouses as well. Okay, he's drinking coffee or she's getting a tattoo, but what's next,
right?
Like maybe I can handle that, but that's not really the fear. The fear is, what's the slippery slope of what's coming? Could it be that this person wants an open marriage, or could it be that they want a divorce, or could it be that they, you know, they're going to tell my children things about the church that I don't want them to tell them, or, you know, so things that it can become legitimately scary for people who the contract has been switched, you know, in a sense.
Absolutely. And I remember even thinking that about myself, you know, because oftentimes one of the themes you hear in church, not from everybody, but occasionally, is, oh, well, if it wasn't for the church, we would all be out doing terrible things. Like, it's the church that keeps us from, without the gospel, we'd just be terrible, terrible people. Well, I don't think that's true. And I think churches and religion can help people and help build communities, but it can have the reverse effect on these folks. You know, it's interesting. My answer now, after observing these people for 10 years, is you have Mormons who don't drink, and then you have ex-Mormons who drink. And then you have ex-Mormons who neither drink nor don't drink, you know. And the question is, what's next? It drops as a signifier. Mm-hmm. You know, Mormons drink coffee, Mormons don't drink coffee, ex-Mormons drink coffee, and then everybody else either does or doesn't. It's not, and that's a very Mormon construction, like that slippery, an American construction too. But that slippery slope of, oh, you're going to go to this point, you know, coffee is the gateway to vodka, which leads to pot, which leads to heroin, right?
Right.
And that's the path, you know.
Right. Well, and I think what you're getting at, which is I think a lot of the times what I try to work with people on as well, and in my own life, is this kind of claiming of your own spiritual journey or maybe enlightened journey, whatever language you want to give that, where it's claiming your values, claiming your ethics, claiming your space in society, and those come with certain identifiers that people do need to figure out for themselves. And I think what you're describing is the process of getting to that point.
Yeah, and I would say to everybody, it's not as bad. The behaviors themselves are not as bad. Now, if we start transitioning into that identity again. You know, I've had couples come to my house and, you know, say, let's say the man has lost his faith and then you know, the woman is struggling. And I've seen this it's not gender specific, the gender roles I've seen reversed. What I learned to tell people early on is to, you know, usually it was the ex-Mormon hauling them to me to try to get me to explain to the poor Mormon there why they should leave the church. What they quickly learned is I told the ex-Mormon that you're the one who changed, right? You're the one who broke all the rules. You had this marriage that you set up, and it had certain promises, and you're the one who reneged on those. And you really have to process this identity, this faith crisis on the hands of one person on the same plane as infidelity. That's what it feels like to Mormons, because they're really betraying their marriage vows. And taking and extending that model, that's the way it feels to everybody who are the family members. Because in Mormonism, the sealing and the idea of families being forever is not just between the marriage partner. It's between everybody. It's the kids and the parents and the ward. And it's such an act of betrayal to leave the church, which is another reason why ex-Mormons thrash. They suddenly lose all this connection and they're lost in the world. They're like teenagers. They're going to show people that they can be, well, you know, either sometimes they're going to be as bad as they think they're going to be. They're going to, you know, do whatever it is. They're going to get tattooed up and buy a Harley Davidson or whatever to establish their new identity. But for others, there's a big pressure on ex-Mormons to feel perfect. I felt like that. Like if I felt like there were tons of people watching me, and if I made a mistake, they would say, see, you needed the gospel. Without the gospel, you're nothing. But either way, there's a lot of pressure. And I know from talking to my parents, they felt the same sort of pressure as when I would come around. Like, they felt like they couldn't say or imply anything bad about the church. Where in the past, when I was a member, we would all sit around and kind of degas ourselves a little bit and, you know, kind of whine about our callings, not in a very playful, not harmful way. But they won't do that around me at all because they feel like they have to protect the church from me, even though my family and I never talk about like Whitefields or Mormon Express or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But that's a lot of pressure on all of us to fill these roles and to not appear to the other side as if we're screwed up.
Yeah. Almost like it becomes polarized, right?
Yeah,
like you were closer to the middle, and then now that you've taken bigger stances, you polarize back and can't even have the types of conversations you used to have.
That's right. And that once again goes to identity. Who am I? What is my relationship to my mother? I'm still my mother's son, but where my mother spends a lot of time doing genealogy, and they go to church, they go to the temple, and they want to go on missions, and I don't do any of that stuff. Like I tell people, like with my family in particular, we've never had an argument or blow up over religion. We don't talk. I don't bring up religion. They don't bring up religion. But it was such a glue to our family. It's such a unifying force that we've sort of lost anything to talk about.
Right.
And that's no one's fault. I look at that and say, who screwed up here? No one did. It's just the reality of the situation. It has to do with that individual identity.
Yeah, you lose the common language. You lose the common language, and then on top of that, you have to learn this whole new dance. If you could see, John and I were kind of dancing with our hand motions. But it is a whole new dance, and it's also this aspect of, like you're saying, not just personal identity, but family identity, community identity. Where do I fit into these circles? What are we allowed to talk about now? Things that I just took for granted or just assumed about you, I can't do anymore. Are we going to really delve deep into those types of conversations, or are we going to stay superficial? I mean, again, that goes into a lot of family dynamics because some families like to delve deep and some don't.
What do you wear to the family picnic? What do you, you know, like, for people who aren't familiar with this cultural dynamic, like something as simple as ordering a glass of wine at dinner is a non-issue anywhere else, but it can be a huge tense issue where everybody's worried about what's going to happen. And like some Mormons, for example, feel very strongly that people under the age of 21 shouldn't even see anybody drink. And so you get these little tiny things that other people would say, what are you talking about? That become hugely impactful to our identity, our relationships. And to extend that model, that doing something like ordering a glass of dinner, ordering a glass of wine at dinner, some Mormons will take as very offensive, as an affront. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure because there's ex-Mormons who have left carrying that same baggage, there's some ex-Mormons, I'm sure, who do it to be offensive and to stick a finger in people's eyes. Yeah, that's the fascinating nuance of that.
It can't be behavior just for the behavior's sake. The behavior has meaning, it has attached meaning, and then therefore, how are the dynamics are going to go, we're going to be.
And I think on the positive side, in my observation, for most people, it does become just the behavior. It loses its significance.
Over time.
Over time. And that's one of the things we're trying to help get people to sooner, you know, so they can stop being reactionaries. They can own their own decisions, whatever that be. I mean, if you want to go to Colorado and smoke pot, go to Colorado and smoke pot, but don't do it to show anybody anything. You know, do it because you own it.
Right, right. So let's get back to sex a little bit, because you talked about this kind of things that you're thinking about and moving people kind of past this original kind of realization that, hey, I may only have one sexual partner my entire life, and what does that mean, and what have I missed out on, or things of that nature, and some of the pendulum shifts, which, I mean, I also have seen, which, again, everybody's got to claim their own journey, so I don't want to my struggle, even like with the Harleys, it's like, if you want a Harley, get a Harley.
Right, right.
Like, I don't want to make anybody feel bad about doing whatever they need to do to figure this out for themselves. But I do agree with you that there comes some inherent risks with opening up yourself sexually, not only physically, obviously, with STDs, which I'm not sure a lot of Mormons know a lot about, because, again, if you've only had one partner, you don't really have to think through that as much as other people who have. So it's kind of like good boy, good girls get pregnant.
I think it's fascinating because I don't talk about this a lot, but I'm kind of a walking encyclopedia about STIs, because when I got divorced and I was suddenly single, I had that Mormon baggage and I went and read the CDC. I read everything I could read because it's really scary.
Right.
And oftentimes the risk, because religious people will use things like STIs as a form of control. Mm-hmm. So oftentimes the risks are overinflated or whatever. Not that STIs don't have a risk, but this goes to our whole identity thing, the way religions sometimes operate and the way people coming out of religion sometimes operate, where they start infusing meaning into all these little things that normal people wouldn't, you know.
Did you have STIs come up a lot as a believing Mormon? I mean, I don't know that that's what was served to put the fear in us.
When I went to sex ed, I graduated in 1991, and when I went to sex ed in high school, it was all just STIs.
Okay.
I mean, that's all it was.
I would agree, in high school, yes.
In my Mormon upbringing, we just didn't talk about sex.
Right, at all.
Yeah.
I would agree. High school sex education is very fear-based, and I guess religious sex education is usually fear-based as well, in different ways, not STIs, but you know, your spiritual salvation is at stake, obviously. So things of that nature. But I guess there is the physical risk, obviously. But more than that, there's emotional risk. And I think sometimes that's, to your point, like when people say, okay, well, the church just fed me this big, you know, kind of lie about sexual chastity being so important. there is some truth behind being careful about your sexual self.
And knowing your own sexual self, and this is what's difficult. And once again, I've had a lot of experiences just from where I've sat, you know, watching some of the polyamorous communities and the open communities and that sort of thing. And it's hard to predict coming out of the church how you're going to react emotionally, sexually. For some people, it's not a big deal. For others, it's an enormous big deal. And it's you because you didn't have a lot of those experiences in college oftentimes, you don't know how you're going to react. And it could go any which direction. It could blow your marriage up or your relationships up in ways that you cannot predict. And that's the really scary thing. On the other hand, if it's something that's consuming to you, that's you fixate on it, it's going to be a big deal also. I'm trying to figure out how in the world to put together some kind of group session or individual sessions, but it's hard because people might not necessarily understand even themselves at that point and know what the issues are, and it's hard to tell people what to do. This is why it's such a struggle for me, is I don't have a good answer on this one.
Yeah.
And luckily, the people I know who have sort of experimented, most people experiment lightly, you know, let's take the gloves off. They might be at a party, they might get drunk, they might go make out with somebody in the corner who's not their spouse. And that's usually enough for people. So, because there gets to be this idea that like ex-Mormons are all in this great big orgy. And there's always this idea that in this, it's always like in Eagle Mountain or in Draper or something, there's these stories of these underground like swinger networks among Mormons. So it's not just ex-Mormons, right?
Yeah. Well, those are happening in my neighborhood in Wichita among the evangelicals. So, you know,
they're always rumored there. And if you look at rates of infidelity and things like, I was going to name off the websites, but I'll leave it to you. There are websites out there where people use to hook up with others, either in fidelity or in an open sort of thing. And these are enormous, like businesses, right? So
Right. There's
a lot of that stuff going on. My point is, and if you talk to any bishop at any time, they're dealing with several cases of infidelity simultaneously.
Right.
This isn't just an ex-Mormon issue. Human sexuality is a huge issue. And things of marriage and commitment and fidelity are something that impacts everybody at some point in their life, whether or not they actually act on it.
Right, right. Yeah, and I think to what you're speaking of is kind of this, to put it in very simplistic terms, is figuring out how to develop and define your sexual healthy self.
Right.
You know, so what is sexual health? And, you know, even as a sex therapist and the conferences I go to, there's a lot of ideas about what sexual health can, you know, mean. But I think that's an important journey for everybody to figure out, is what sexual health means for themselves.
Yeah, for me, and you're the expert, but for me, sexual health is what sex you think is healthy to some. I mean, there's things you could do to damage other people. Don't get me wrong. There's a concrete, objective, dangerous behavior. But for
right.
the most part, sexuality is what you are okay with. But coming out of the church, you don't know what you're okay with. And that's the rub.
Right, right. Yeah, I would agree with that. Okay, so you mentioned being angry for a while. So do we want to talk about kind of some of the basic phases that we talk about when we talk about faith transition? I mean, anger is a pretty common one that I find.
Well, I think the Kubler-Ross model and of anger and denial and you know, acceptance and all those, the stages of grief that, as most people would know, is really common. The best way to understand when people leave the church is they will view the church, because of everything they were told about truth, because the church insists a lot on the truthfulness and authority. So when people leave the church, they process it like you would being defrauded, or being like if your home was robbed while you were gone, mm-hmm. it was burglarized, like this emotional betrayal. And from inside the church, they oftentimes frame it as, oh, people are offended. And that's coming from not understanding this emotional reaction that people are having leaving the church. They seem to be offended because the people leaving feel like they were lied to. They feel like they were defrauded in a very, very significant way. And that comes out as these really angry feelings of hurt and betrayal and anger. And it oftentimes gets overblown. It gets extended to everything. You know, mm-hmm. if you go to discussion boards or Facebook groups of people just leaving the church, I mean, they just tear apart everything with the church. which you see in divorces. Like for most people who divorce, they just take somebody who they loved and were with for a long time, and they just turn completely on that person.
Right.
So it's a common human reaction. I'm not saying it's a healthy one, but it's really common. Yeah. So and then you have this sense of loss. I know for people going through divorce, one of the things they have to mourn is all these dreams that they had. You know, they were planning on building a retirement home in Cape Cod or whatever they were doing, and they have to put all that to bed. Same sort of thing for ex-Mormons. They have to put all these dreams of their afterlife or whatever else, their successful church career, being a bishop. Mm-hmm. They have to mourn all that stuff.
And well, and even familial things like attending your children's temple wedding or going on a mission with your spouse, especially if one of you is still believing, right? Or things of that nature that can be really devastating too.
Yeah, I went to a funeral in the fall. One of my aunts died, and one of her well-meaning sons, he's a great guy, got up and was talking about how successful the family was because they were all the children under seven were still, you know, in the temple. They'd all gone to the temple. But, you know, I look around in the room and I can see that there's a third of the people who aren't there and everybody's feeling bad, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's where some of these emotions and this anger and whatnot comes from, because you're framing it out a particular way. So, yeah, I felt angry. I sound more angry on the podcast than I actually am. I do get angry. Like I have been feeling more things emotionally when we see the hurt. And I see so much pain on both sides. And I know that I've contributed to the pain, so I'm not trying to point fingers at other people. But we don't really have models for these things. We don't know how to channel our feelings properly. I wish at the first sign of losing my faith that I'd gotten into therapy.
Yeah.
It wasn't until I went through a divorce that I went into therapy, and I realized, oh my gosh, this stuff, I should have had this 6-8 years ago.
Well, and back to the taboo topic, I mean, in your modeling comment, these are not things that we feel comfortable talking about. It's a real kind of hush-hush type of topic, and I think church culture in general, if anybody leaves, people are sad, and people might mention it here and there, but it's not something that we know how to converse
about. Well, look at like excommunication. Now, we can argue back and forth whether excommunication is throwing somebody out and shunning them like the Jehovah's Witnesses do or not. But we do know certain things. We tell them they can't pray, they can't teach. So we do literally silence them. We encourage them to keep coming to church.
Pray in public,
absolutely,
by the
true
way. I just want to make sure we
say it again.
Pray in public. That
pray
they can't
pray in
pray
public.
Pray
yeah,
public,
yeah.
Right.
Absolutely. They're encouraged right to pray privately. I'm talking about in the meeting. But so what that does inadvertently is now people don't know how to interact with this person. This person's not participating in the dialogue. And I think that's just metaphoric for what happens in general when people lose their faith. They don't know how to interact with them, and they don't know if they're safe. They don't know if their children should be around them. And it's just everybody loses their sense of what do I do? How do I achieve a new normal?
Right. Well, and I think the statistics show that people who are excommunicated, there's a high percentage that don't come back. I think for many of those reasons, I mean, faith issues too, but it's very, very challenging to come back to a community that where you feel like you don't have a voice, where you feel like you're not able to know how to manage your discussions with people, et cetera. So joining us right now, we have Lindsay Hansen-Park. Thank you, Lindsay, for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Meetings, so you couldn't join us at the very beginning. But Lindsay is the Director of Counseling Services for Whitefields Education Foundation, and so wanted to be able to talk with both her and John about some of the things that we've been talking about. So just to
kind of... We've been talking about sex, Lindsay.
And I missed it. Oh, no. All the fun stuff.
So I wanted to kind of get your perspective. I know John has been through kind of his own faith transition, and we've been talking about kind of some of the common things that people who are going through faith transitions are facing. And so we've talked about, you know, not knowing how to talk to their family members. We've talked about some of the behavioral implications. You know, am I going to drink coffee or have sex or drink wine? You know, those kinds of things. Wear my garments. You know, those kinds of things that people have to choose now. And so I just thought I'd welcome you into that discussion and see what you might have to say about. I know you're also maybe a faith transition person yourself. If you want to speak to that, you can. But I know even more than your personal experience, you've worked with a lot of people who are faith transitioning.
Yeah, and I think that's what makes me really valuable to the work that we're doing here is John has sort of done this a couple years ago, so he's looking at it from a different perspective. But I've been involved with this as I've kind of had this disruption to my faith identity currently. So I feel like I know what I'm talking about. I feel like I understand the feelings and the pain that other people are going through because I've really had to live it in. The change in my faith and the transition of my faith has radically changed my life. It's disrupted everything about my life. It's changed my family relationships. It's changed my community relationships. It's changed my employment. It's changed everything. And so I feel really committed to this work because of it.
So for those, I mean, a classic question that you might get is why? Why is it so defining? I mean, it's just what you believe. What's the big deal? What are some of the maybe pushback things that you would get from people who maybe don't quite understand or haven't gone through something similar themselves?
Well, we often hear from some of our faithful family members, I don't understand. If you have a problem with the church, why don't you just leave it? Or you can leave the church, but you can't leave it alone. And that's just, I mean, it's structurally impossible to do in the way that the LDS community is set up. It's set up more than just a belief system. It's a community system, and it's designed to be that way. And it's historically designed to be that way. It was a survival mechanism for the saints over here. So you can't just stop believing something and then not consider yourself Mormon anymore. I mean, most of us have based entire life choices around this identity. So in my example, I've grown up in the church. I was born in the church. Most of my decisions where I went to school was based on prayer, was based on this Mormon sense of prayer, what I was going to go into, what I was going to study, who I was going to marry. All of those were based on church-based decisions. And then where we live and how we decided to raise our kids and all of that is a Mormon decision. And so once my Mormon faith changed, you can't undo some of those decisions that you made based on your church paradigm, if that makes any sense. So when you change your faith, when your faith changes, as all faith does, I mean, faith, it's an ironic thing that we talk about losing your faith. Faith to me is organic. It's always changing. I don't care who you are. I don't care how faithful you consider yourself to be. If you're a Mormon and you believe in the doctrine of eternal progression, then your faith is supposed to change, right? But we think of it as something you have or you don't have, something you lose or something you gain, and that's just not accurate. And so my faith has changed, and unfortunately, it changed in such a way that made me on the outside, as Ali Isom would say, put me on the outside of my congregation. I wasn't excommunicated or anything, but I took a step away because I was in such pain, and there was no community structure in place that allowed me to explore my pain and my questions and my doubts in my current congregation. So I made the choice to stop attending church because there were really no other choices that I knew of at the time. And the fallout from that, the repercussions from making that choice, that simple choice, I was just going to take a break, were so great that it's really made it difficult for me to feel welcome in my congregation or to even have a desire to go back. And I know that plays into the whole stereotypes of Mormons being offended, but I think that if Mormons are going to accuse other people of being offended, they have to take responsibility for being offensive. And sometimes we are. When people question and are different and doubt, Mormons can be offensive.
It's hard to know how to like when somebody within is changing the dance, we talked about dancing earlier, it's hard to know then how to engage in the new dance with people, especially when an entire congregation is doing one dance and all of a sudden you're taking different steps that they don't know how to manage, you don't know how to manage. And I think that what you're explaining is pretty accurate, that people just start feeling so uncomfortable or so unwelcome or so not, I guess, safe in that environment anymore, that it's very easy to not want to return. Now, I know that many believing members would take issue with that, right? Because there's a huge feeling of the importance of friendship and the importance of making people feel welcome. And I think Mormons take great pride in that. And many times do a good job at that, especially when things are going well. But what would you say then, as far as, and maybe both you and John can talk a little bit about, if we're going to reach out to the people, I mean, we've been talking, I think, mainly to the audience that maybe is going through a faith transition themselves, but let's take a shift now and talk to the audience that maybe they're believing members, they love the church, they're very comfortable in their congregations, and either they want to know how to help those in situations like we're talking about, or they have family members or friends who are going through something similar. What ideas do you have? Or even like bishops or Relief Society presidents who find themselves in positions with people who go inactive or are not comfortable in the wards anymore. What thoughts do you have?
I want to say one thing more about being offended. So when people like me, one of the excuses we always talk about when people leave the church is being offended. And people like me get defensive and we say, no, it was over a doctrinal issue or a historical issue. But actually, I think it is accurate that many of us get offended, because I think if our community was more open to doubt and to questions and to diversity, that I can't help but wonder that if we were more open, if people had those things, if they didn't feel so pushed out by the congregation. And I know it's well-intentioned and things like that, but I can say this as someone who was on the other side of it. I have told this story before on John's podcast, but I kicked out my best friend in college. She went away. She went to a concert with her boyfriend, and they went to Chicago for it, and I felt like it was wicked and wrong that she would travel with a boy alone. And so while she was gone, I organized all the roommates to kick her out of our dorm. And I felt like I was doing this. I know it doesn't make sense to a lot of people, but I felt like I was standing up for what I believed in, and I was trying to help her do it too. So my intentions, of course, I thought were good. And I was doing something really damaging and painful, but I thought I was standing up for what was right. And that's kind of an extreme example, but I see so many people think that they are doing what is right. They think it's their position to correct someone else's behavior. We do a lot of boundary policing and behavioral policing in Mormonism. We want to change people. And as I've learned in therapy, the unsafe people in my life are the people that want to change me. And unfortunately, I think that our community, the good thing about our community, our Mormon community, is that we are close and we have more lax boundaries with each other. We trust one another. But that can also be bad, because that means we're stepping in over boundaries that we don't really need to step, like telling someone that they need to go back to church more, they need to pray more, or whatever it is that we think that our answers would be their answers, if that makes sense.
Sure. John, what would you add to that?
Yeah, we've talked a lot about that identity, and it's interesting how much we, both Mormons and ex-Mormons, put a lot of weight in these little symbols, and we talked about that quite a bit. I think the advice to both ex-Mormons and to Mormons is the same thing. It's stop fussing about the details, because, and I don't know what it is about our culture, but it's not we have to wear a Sunday best, but no, then you have to wear a white shirt, and then you have to wear a tie, and the tie can't be too, like when I was young, the ties, we had rules about how skinny the tie could be. So it's not just you had to dress up, and not just you had to wear a white tie, white shirt, not just you had to wear a white shirt and tie, but the tie had to fit a certain paradigm and standard. And it's like we were always trying to out-Mormon each other. And then the ex-Mormons are just trying to out-ex-Mormon each other. They're doing they're playing the same game. And if we can realize and follow some of our evangelical brothers and sisters, they're much better at this, where they don't put as much meaning and all that kind of stuff. And if we can do that, if we can drop the meaning, that the meaning that coffee has for a Mormon is not the meaning that it has for an ex-Mormon or for a non-Mormon. And if we can just realize that these things are arbitrary. And I don't mean to slight them by saying they're arbitrary, because I think faithful people would say these are things that God gives us as standards. I mean, even as a Mormon, I was told that God told folks in the Old Testament not to eat pork. And we can eat bacon now. And that didn't make God arbitrary, that God gave certain rules for people to abide by. And I was taught that framework and that paradigm. That's actually a healthy one. But we forget it. We forget the idea that if somebody leaves the church, then coffee doesn't have the same meaning for them. So don't ascribe it with that meaning. Don't judge people by that. And once again, I'm not laying this sin at the feet of the believers. It's equally around, because we all do that. And if we could just learn to drop that and learn to say, listen, if somebody's wearing sleeveless clothing, they're not a hussy. They are just, that's just what they want to wear. And it doesn't have the same meaning it has.
And I want to say something else. I think we like to talk about the scriptures, and there's the parable of the lost sheep, and Jesus goes after the one. And I think sometimes, at least in my case, I thought going after the one meant grabbing them and carrying them and making them come back. And the scriptures also teach us about the wilderness. When God wants his prophets to learn something, he often sends them out into the wilderness for a while. And a lot of the, at least in my case, the questions I had, it felt like I was in my own wilderness, and it was lonely and it was difficult, but it was important for me. It would have been nice to have a friend out there in the wilderness every once in a while checking in on me. But I think that in our Mormon paradigm, if we can't grab that person and carry them back with us, then we're happy to send them off to the wilderness and never see them again. We want them gone and we don't want them back. And I think that we need to, it's like John said, we just need to drop those things. People are on their own journeys, and we have to let go of that control. And if we are going to love someone, to me, love means support and compassion and understanding. And unfortunately, I've heard the word love used as a weapon. I can't tell you how many times I've heard from family members, "We love you, but we're unhappy with your life choices." And to be completely honest, my life choices haven't really changed, except for I decided not to attend my meetings. But that is lost on them, because it's like John said, they're holding on to these markers, these arbitrary markers. I haven't had one person ask me what was going on in my heart, but I've had many, many, many people ask me why I'm not at church. And I think that that's interesting, that that's a question that people ask. Why aren't you at a church? Not, how are you feeling? And I really think that if we kind of shift our focus on watching and paying attention, keeping track of what people are doing and what they're not doing, who's checking what off the list, that would be really, really helpful.
What would you both say to the concept of fear? Like, what place does fear play in all of this?
Well, I remember when my best friend fell away. I hate that term. When she
chose a different path.
Fell away.
I'm so Mormon. When she decided to go to a concert with her boyfriend.
Was it a rock and roll concert?
It was.
Though?
It was a Smashing Pumpkins, and the Smashing Pumpkins. But, you know, she was being naughty because it was with a boy. And turns out they didn't even do anything later on, which, you know, is not scandalous at all. But I was so scared. Fear is the only emotion I can think of. I was scared, and I was really hurt because I had gone to Young Women's with this girl, and I'd been at girls' camp with her and testimony meetings, and to have her question, I thought, you can't do this. And it wasn't so much, I look back at it now, and it was almost like feeling left alone, like, you can't leave me. But that's not how I interpreted it at the time. I was scared. I was scared that she was doing the wrong thing. I mean, that was the surface. It was just scared. But underneath that fear, I think it was control. I mean, I was taught to watch what my friends did and to help them, and I'm using air quotes for help, by have them make the right choices. I mean, in Young Women's, we got so many lessons about helping the priesthood in our life make right choices right before they went on missions. And I did the same thing with everyone around me. I would tell them if I thought that they were making bad choices. And I've had family members do that. I think that they're scared. I think they're scared for what it means for my faith. I think they're scared for what it means for their faith. And you know what? If I were a parent and my child, you know, had a transition in faith, I would be really scared for what that meant, not just eternally, but for what that meant for who I was. If I invested my entire life teaching a child a certain thing and sacrificed hours for family on the evening and hours for church and for camp and all of those things, what does that say about me and my job as a parent? What does that say about me when my child takes all of that, all those sacrifices, and seemingly throws them away? That's a scary, scary thing.
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, there's a lot of great aspects of Mormonism, but fear as a teaching tool is probably one of the negative elements, at least in the way I was raised. I know not all people were raised in faith the way I was. But, you know, it's kind of like if you're trying to teach a child to go to university, you can take a positivist approach and say, you know, you can get a better job, you can have more freedom, you can accomplish more things, have more creativity. Or you can say, you're going to be in debt, you're not going to be able to take vacation, your life's going to be messed up. And I think oftentimes in the religion, we tend to focus more on the negative. If you don't do this, you're going to go to hell. It's not just, hey, beautiful heaven awaits, but you got to be on the straight and narrow. Not only do you have to go to heaven, you have to go to the top heaven. Not only have to go to the top heaven, you have to go to the top heaven of the top heavens.
You'll never see your family again.
Yeah, and I think that fear translates externally. Strangely enough, it can be empowering. I know that for me, I'm not a big drinker. I talk a bigger talk than I do. But it was very empowering for me because there was alcoholism in my family, and just demon rum was demon rum. It destroyed everything. And to realize that I had power over that was very cathartic for me emotionally. I think on the same route in terms of a positive approach to this inner dialogue between Mormons and ex-Mormons, to realize that these models don't have to be that way. I've heard these wonderful stories of people leaving the church and then their parents buying a coffee maker just to make them feel comfortable. I mean, for me, that melts my heart because I know what that means for a Mormon. And I know what a huge gift that is. Once again, we were talking before about things that wouldn't make sense to anybody else. And just those small reaches. Because as Lindsay was saying, there is an offense when people leave the church. Ex-Mormons are pretty offensive as a group, and Mormons can be pretty offensive when they like circle up the wagons and you know, well, here's another one that's lost. We're going to, and then we get into this standoff, this war of escalation.
Well, I think, you know, one begets the other, yeah, if you will. I mean, John and I often talk about this. I don't know if you talked about this earlier, but how ex-Mormons take their Mormon baggage with them. You know, whatever bad aspects they were as a Mormon, they take that with them. And I've really tried not to do that myself. But one of the things that I've done is I lived in a community and in a household where speaking out, speaking up was okay as long as it was, you know, the approved things to say and the approved doctrine and it wasn't critical of the church. But once it was critical or negative, then we couldn't talk about it, and that was me being, you know, led away by Satan and all of those things, which is very, very fear-based. Thinking you're being led away by Satan is very, very fear-based. And so when I was able to question, I couldn't stop questioning, and I think that's why I got in the podcast, because you kind of – ex-Mormons really overshare, don't they, John? We just kind of spit it all out.
Well, and it's a reversal, just like you're saying. Like Mormons, one of the control mechanisms in the church is – silence and fear, and you know, like you have to, you don't confess things, you only talk to your bishop, and then bishop has power over that. And next Mormons reverse it, promiscuous disclosure. There were secrets before, now we're going to tell you everything.
And
you
know, and that can often run in like at family parties. And you know, I've been on this journey for like just 3 years, but I remember when the bishop would come over, the first counselor, I would sit in my living room and they would say, "How are you?" And it would just all come out like this word vomit volcano. And I just had a recent experience with a neighbor who we kind of had this sort of issue of shunning, I guess, and she was coming to apologize, which is really great. And it was such good practice for me to sit there, because there was that part of me that wanted to say, I want you to understand me. I want you to understand where I'm coming from. I want to tell you all the issues, because if you know what I do, then you'll feel the same way. But it was so much more tempered. And it was good for me to juxtapose that to how I felt when I was first going through this. And there is just such a strong desire to be understood. And, you know, you're taught to bear your testimony for your whole life. And then you're all of a sudden not allowed to talk to your family about what you believe. That's really hard to do.
It is, yeah. Yeah, that was a conundrum that was very difficult, and I didn't handle it correctly. I didn't approach my parents. They found out in the newspaper that I left the church. But I had no idea. I still have no idea how to broach that subject. And to Lindsay's point, these are the things that are most core to who we are, to who our identity is. There's our theme. But then suddenly, if you talk about it, you're being offensive. Like, to talk about faith in a derogatory sort of way from their perspective is one of the most offensive things you can do. So oftentimes ex-Mormons are stuck in this thing where they can either be secretive and skulk off, Or they can be confrontational, and there's no middle ground.
Well, and likewise, you know, how many times has an ex-Mormon said, oh my gosh, my mom won't stop talking to me about the church? Whereas in a normal relationship, your mom is always talking about the church because that's what her calling is and that's what she does for her job. But now all of a sudden it becomes offensive. And this is what I think you and I are fighting against, John, is these binaries. And Mormonism has turned Mormonism needed binaries to do what it did, to come across the plains and to fight against the government and to establish itself as a religion and as a people. But now it's kind of, now that we're integrated with the rest of society, it's kind of this weird dynamic, and we have to get away from the binaries. That's what I would say. If you are a black and white thinker, okay, here's advice for your listeners. Don't ever tell your loved one who's struggling with a faith, well, you either believe the church or you don't. You either believe Joseph Smith was a prophet of God or you don't. You either believe the Book of Mormon is the word of God or you don't. It is not so simple. Life is not that simple. God is not that simple. So why on earth should faith be that simple? And it's the same thing with ex-Mormons. The church is all bad or it's all good. You should leave it or you should make it change. You know, you stay back and change. There's all these binaries. We just got to move away from those. Life is way too complicated for that.
I agree.
Yeah, and that I agree too. And I think that's what it really is, an invitation to a more messy existence. And I think that's what we're all a little bit scared of or uncomfortable with, right? But it is, I think, in that mess that we find more intimacy and more acceptance and more ability to connect with those that really mean the world to us, like spouses and family members and all these people that, you know, friends, dear friends that we've grown up with and so forth. Two thoughts before we close. I do think that you both made good points kind of about this. Do what is right, let the consequence follow, can definitely fall on both sides of the equation, right? Yeah. And I think we find that, you know, and I think that's why we do take these stances that I think speak to our convictions. And so whether you're on one side or the other, that's something that happens. And I think oftentimes when these offenses take place, which is unfortunate, not that we shouldn't stand for things that we believe in, but how we do that is oftentimes the process, right, that we're all trying to work on. And one thing I think that John, you said and directly and Lindsay indirectly is this idea of not blaming or trying to convert the other. So in other words, it's nobody's fault that we think things the way we do. It's nobody's fault that we kind of get to have our own faith journey. I mean, that's a very Mormon thing actually, right? That we all have our own journey here on earth and that we get to use our agency and our brain and our relationship with God to figure out what that testimony is going to be per se. And so I liked that. And then the last piece I think I would say is finding what we still have in common. We have so much in common. We tend to focus, I think, so much on what we have different, right? And that messes us up sometimes in relationships.
Yeah, and this is me speaking from a lot of distance from the communities. And if you talk to some of my favorite people are the hanger-oners. They're people.
You're talking about me.
No, you're still in it.
Well, thank
these
you.
These are people who like married into. I have some fabulous friends who are married into this whole Mormon thing. They've never been Mormons, and I love sitting and talking to them because they see ex-Mormons and Mormons exactly the same. You know, it's just what they talk about. But it takes a long time to start dropping those Mormon identity elements. And for me, it was about 8 years out of the church before I stopped thinking about a Mormon. When I stopped thinking like a Mormon, I mean, when I pick up a cup of coffee, I don't process it. But it took a long, long time for that to happen before it was either I didn't drink coffee or now I was drinking coffee and ooh, that's naughty, or now I'm drinking coffee and yeah, stick it to the man, until it just had no meaning. And it took a long time for that just to diffuse. And I think Mormons and ex-Mormons are culturally and the way they process the world much more similar than they want to admit.
Yeah. And I would just want to say one more thing, that if someone in your life is questioning, it is not a personal attack on you. When I questioned, it had nothing to do but my own relationship with God, which is what we encourage. But so often, like when my best friend did, I thought that she was leaving me. I thought that I had to fix it, and I felt hurt, like she was hurting me. And that's just, it's just not accurate. So if someone in your life is questioning, it's not an attack on you. And I would hope that we would never ask anyone to believe for us, because I know that I wouldn't ever want that responsibility. That sounds very Mormon. But if we believe that we're supposed to gain our own testimonies, then let's let people do it. And if they have a testimony of coffee or exploring the world or going out in the wilderness, as I say, then let people claim their testimony. And I would say likewise to ex-Mormons, let people claim the testimony. Ex-Mormons are in a unique position that they can understand faith on both sides. And so I would say use that as a tool to remember what devotion felt like and to be gentle with it.
Agreed.
No, thank you. That's very good. And I really appreciate that both of you have said things like, you know, I've been doing this for 8 years. I've been doing this for 3 years. This is a long process. This is not something that usually happens in a month or two.
And I'm not over it by any means.
And it's, I think, something that I think to your point, John, earlier is a faith. Well, and Lindsay, too, that faith is something that we're constantly evolving in and constantly thinking about. And our relationship to the world, our relationship to others, our relationship to our communities is something that we need to continually be developing and thinking about and processing. So thank you so much for being on the program. You spoke so well to so many issues. We could probably spend many more hours talking about each one of the issues we brought up. But this is a complicated thing. I know many people in our church communities are dealing with faith transitions in one way or another, on one side or the other of the spectrum. And I would hope, like I think most of us would agree, that connection and communication and love wins out in the end, that those are the things that win.
Amen.
Amen.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Mental Health. To discuss this episode, please check us out at mormonmentalhealth.org. To keep the podcast alive, please consider a donation today, again, at mormonmentalhealth.org. Logo was provided by Daniel Singer. Music was generously donated by Lower Lights. Please check them out at thelowerlights.com. And thanks for listening.
Chart and compass came from thee, Jesus saved.